if you like betting on golf. But everyone that you back misses the cut. Get some experts involved with all the stats and the tips and so much more. 'Cause it's the golf betting system. The golf betting system is the golf betting system podcast.
Greetings and welcome to the Golf Betting System podcast 138. Paul Williams and Barry O'Hanrahan are with me to discuss who we are backing at the Vivint Houston Open on the PGA Tour and the Cyprus Showdown on the European Tour. Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning, guys.
Morning, guys.
This podcast is for listeners of 18 and above. Please be gamble aware. You can visit begambleaware.org for more information. And, of course, please bet responsibly. Visit our world-famous golf betting system website with our in-depth betting previews, masses of tournament stats, and our predictor models, all available completely free of charge with no paywall. Please subscribe to this podcast and drive the popularity of the show. We're available on social media. You can cheer Barry up on at A Good Talk Golf. We're deep into our COVID lockdown. Well, Barry is, and we're just about to go into one here in the UK. I'm available at Bamford Golf. Paul is available at Golf Betting. You can join our Golf Betting System Facebook group. The link is available in the description box. Plus, look out for the Steve Bamford Golf YouTube channel, where I present the Golf Betting Show every week. Now, as I say at the start of every show, please take time and to rate and five-star review us on Apple Podcasts. And this week would be fantastic because we have two, I keep getting asked this, gentlemen, what Masters content are you doing? Well, we're going to do two Masters podcasts, one this week and then one next Tuesday for the 2020 Masters. So any reviews that come in, I promise to read them out at the start of our Masters podcasts, which will be very, very popular. So please give us a five-star review. Here's one. It's from Oliver's Twisters. He's in the United States of America.
Good name.
I know, Oliver's good Twisters. Name. Yeah. Entitled, Wow, Guys, five stars. The depth of information you guys provide has allowed me to only feel the need to listen to one golf podcast instead of multiple. Wow. Can't believe your website isn't behind a paywall also. Also, enjoy the soothing British accent. We sound a bit different here in East Tennessee. So thank you for that, Oliver's Twisters.
Oh, that's the first time you've been described as soothing, Steve.
He's not talking about me. He's talking his British accent. He must be describing Barry.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, dear. East Tennessee.
Yeah, that, speak to be Queens fair, though, better
that,
than you.
That is an outstanding review when he's saying that he used to listen to multiple podcasts and now he only listens to us.
Yeah, very good.
Many I don't know thanks. If that's good or dangerous.
There's another way to get through multiple podcasts. Just play them on a faster speed.
That's very true.
It's, yeah, it's down to one podcast. That's good. Mm. There are so many out there, so appreciate you tuning into this one.
Definitely.
Last week, I was dry on the Bermuda. Peter Malnati started well. Then he started faffing about when the wind came.
First round leader, Malnati, wasn't he?
He was. I had Scott Piercy, who was also right in the mix. I think they were both in the top 10 come Saturday. Excuse me. And then they did absolutely nothing Saturday. And then Piercy was... I think Malnati was still in the hunt. I needed him to shoot 5-6 under, but he shot level. And it was Piercy that shot 5 under. Piercy's his putting's really poor at the moment, but his tee to green game's really good. But yes, short golf course, coastal golf course, howling wind. Friday and Saturday. So those rounds have been recorded and put onto our wind 5-year statistic for the predictor model because that wind was certainly howling on the Friday. And it just, as it, you know, two winners, one Brendan Todd, one Brian Gay. They are effectively the same players, aren't they?
Yeah, style-wise. Yeah, it's impressive from Gay because he's... incoming form was really, really poor. I don't know if you saw the post-round interview when he talked about how he'd been playing since lockdown, but basically saying that he's been playing really, really badly. But you get him to a track which suits him, which appeals to his strengths. Clearly, he'd played well the year before, and I think he finished third or fourth or something like that the year before. And, yeah, it all comes flooding back. Thought he'd blown it when he got to that, what was it, the par five where he made bogey.
17.
Yeah, right towards the end. But incredible birdie on the last to get in the playoff. And he makes the putt in the playoff, and we know he can putt. With one thing we know about Brian Gay is that boy can putt.
And that wedge shot to 18 in regulation, after pulling the previous one, I know it was into the wind on 17, but to... Like, he absolutely flushed that on 18. You could hear it and see it. And you just had a feeling it was dropping close. And you felt you felt great from seeing him do it as well. After the... So often, like, a golfer has a disappointment and the chance for redemption, and it just doesn't happen because golf is a dick. But it wasn't on Sunday for Brian Gay. And it was kind of a cool thing to see him immediately bounce back with that birdie and give himself a chance.
Yep. Yeah, and he knew the shot was good, didn't he, from the second it left his
club. Yeah. You could see it in his, well, it threw his sunglasses into his eyes, but yeah.
It was, golf bettors and golf punters have been hot on Wyndham Clark for a while, haven't they? I can remember, was it the 3M Open last year when he was up there after 54 holes with DeChambeau, with Wolf, with Colin Morikawa? And he blew up badly on the Sunday.
Yeah, he looked really wobbly coming down the street.
But he's one of those, isn't he? He's absolutely monstrous off the tee and he can putt. Everything in between's a bit iffy. But when he actually finds form with those approach shots and the around the green game as well, he's a dangerous animal, Wyndham Clark.
Yeah.
How do you think he'll bounce back this week? Because clearly on this golf course in Houston, which I think is going to be... a bomber's paradise to a certain extent, it's right up his street again.
Yeah, and this is always the question, isn't it? Can players shrug off that disappointment immediately and get back into contending form, or does it take a week or two? Less so on the PGA Tour. I think the players on the PGA Tour are a little bit better in that respect. You often see on the European Tour, a player finishes kind of third or fifth or whatever, miscut the following week, and then maybe back to contention the start after that. But I think the PGA Tour players are generally a little bit better. But, yeah, difficult.
Every time I back the week after a player that's been in a playoff, they play awful. So I expect Wyndham Clark to win this week.
Should maybe change that strategy, Steve. It doesn't sound very profitable.
Well, no, that's why I haven't backed him this week.
That's another post-it note for the wall, Esther.
Yeah,
about 30. I'm looking at him right now. The only thing I will say about Brian Gay, he missed the cut by, I think it was a shot or two at TPC Summit in the Shriners. Don't forget that was an 8-under cut or 7-under. It was something crazy. And the thing he'd found was the putter. And then he goes to a course he likes. Bearing in mind, wasn't he on 5-6 straight missed cuts? Goes to a course he likes, the wind blows, and lo and behold. Back to the old Brian Gay. That is 5 PGA Tour victories for Brian Gay now. 4 of them on Bermuda grass.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's only a couple of years off the seniors as well, isn't he? So it's going to be another one who's competitive on the generally shorter tracks that they play on the senior tour when he gets there.
Do you want to talk about Cyprus, Paul?
One second,
poor old Sammy Falamaki.
Yeah, no, let Barry talk first, please.
Well, just I have one more point just to raise about the short hitting guys. I find it like they almost deserve extra credit because they only have a certain amount of tournaments each year, and which are becoming fewer and further between, that they have a genuine chance at winning. So, like, just pick two off the top of your head: Harbortown and last week there in Bermuda. And for these short guys to pop up and perform so well in that one week. I mean, it's kind of admirable that they have that one chance and that they don't kind of succumb to the pressure. I mean, obviously a few of them succumb to the pressure, but for one or two of them to get up there and do what they do on the short course is remarkable. But it also kind of guides me to the point that these tour pros are, like, they're so close all the time to just finding that one little trigger or one thing to click. I mean, case in point, Ollie Schneiderjans hasn't been having the best of times. I suppose that's fair to say. His brother's in the field last week, and for some reason that gave him a kick up the arse, and he plays brilliantly and finishes, what was it, third?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just that little mental trigger, that one thing. So, you know, back to your strokes gained mental game, Steve. If we could have that one factor, you could throw all the other stats out the window.
Yeah, and this is often part of the narrative, isn't it? When you're trying to decide between a shortlist of players, and if you can pick on these you know, narrative points that may well influence a player, then it's either a stroke of genius when you pluck the right one out, or it's it falls flat in its face. But certainly with these shorter tracks, players who would ordinarily not be able to compete on some of the more regular PGA Tour venues simply because they're too long, when they come to these tracks, you know, for them it must be a target. It must be a mental and peaking target for them to get to the point where they're going to be able to be competitive on these tracks that really do suit their game. And, you know, case in point last week with Brian Gay, once again, if you can overlook, and plenty of people did, I saw lots and lots of winning tickets last week on the Facebook group, on Twitter as well, where people had looked at his previous course form
and just looked at backed the price. Him blindly at 200 to 1.
Looked at his price and thought, well, you know, at 200 to 1, I'm willing to overlook the fact that he's missed four cuts in the trot or whatever the number was. And the reward's there if you can overlook that. It's another useful pointer, isn't it? It's another thing to put in the back of the mind for when these quirky events come round.
Clearly on the PGA Tour, we've now got the Masters next week. Where I think you need to be kind of Bryson DeChambeau long next week potentially. We've then got the conclusion of the Ireland tour, so you've got El Chameleon for the Mayakoba Classic, and you've then got the RSM Classic. Two golf courses again where you can be as short as you want and still be very competitive.
Yeah.
And so players that aren't long off the tee can thrive on the PGA Tour this time of year. And you look at Brian Gay, I mean, he's just locked up what effectively a 3-year exemption.
Oh yeah, it takes him through to the seniors.
And he's playing the Masters next year. Can you imagine Brian Gay around Augusta National?
Yeah, I'm not sure he's going to be winning that, but
he'll be approaching most of those par fours with driver.
He's just going to have like driver, 2-wood, 3-wood, 4-wood, 5-wood, and three hybrids, one wedge and a putter.
Yeah, you never know, he might go on the Bryson diet over the next 6 months.
He probably needs to grow about 7 inches in height as well.
Yeah.
Sammy Falamaki.
Thanks for reminding me, Steve. Yeah, disappointment, wasn't it? And that second week on the trot, really, the kind of consensus pick across the whole of golf betting Twitter, certainly. Previously, the week before, everyone was on Adrian Aus, and he could have won. He just played the par fives poorly. Last week, Sammy Valimaki, who opened at 50 to 1, which I snared a little bit off before that disappeared. He went off around about 25 to 1 after everyone in the world had backed him.
You started the trend, though, Paul. You said on the post-Wentworth podcast, watch out for Sammy Falamaki. He played unbelievable golf at the BMW PGA.
Yeah, he led the field for greens in regulation, which was a real eye-catcher. And 50 to 1 was a gift. I mean, the price had to be taken. Three shots clear part of the way through Friday, and two shots clear after he played the 11th on Sunday. And it was trading around about 1.6, or was that 6-4 on that kind of price, and then made three bogeys and four holes and lost it. And by the time he teed up on the 17th, he couldn't win because he needed to make holding one eagle, because Chinquin had just finished birdie eagle and put himself four strokes ahead. It was it changed so dramatically and so quickly in that last 90 minutes or so. Very, very annoying and very frustrating. Not just for me. As I say, there were an awful lot of people who were on Valimaki too. And these kind of consensus picks, the ones where absolutely everyone's on them, they, they don't tend to do well, do they? Which is a shame, really. Not that you can preempt that on a Monday afternoon or a Tuesday morning, but you know, everyone sees the same thing, everyone goes down the same route, and everyone feels the same pain at the end of the week. Shame, because he was absolutely ripe to win that last week. A fair play to Callum Shinquin, though, to finish the way he did. Birdie eagle, birdie on the playoff hole. And Callie Simoia didn't do much wrong at all, really, I mean, other than missing the 5 footer or so on the playoff to keep it going.
That wasn't a good putt.
No, the pressure was on by that point. You'd put your proper match play by that point, aren't you? And Shinquin had made his putt and, you know, he asked the question. And he asked the question in that kind of pressurised situation, and you know, the answer can be something that you don't want to see. But so yeah, that's a bit of redemption there for Shinquin, because he still had that Scottish Open blow up haunting him back from 2017, 2018 maybe.
He's put on a bit of bulk since then, hasn't he?
Yeah.
You could really see it when they went to the 2017 pictures. You know, he was quite skinny, a bit of a whippet, and yeah, he's added a bit of bulk and length.
Yeah, he's filled out.
He's not fat like Renton. He's just a bigger boy now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, a couple of years down the line, and clearly been doing a bit of work in the gym. And he should move on from that. I think that'll get that monkey off his back in terms of what happened at the Scottish Open a couple of years back, and see him move on from there. He's certainly capable of more, I would imagine. But we shall see. Johannes Veerman was one that really caught the eye last week. You'd been on him quite recently, Barry, I think.
The week before, yeah.
The week before, yeah.
And then he started playing really well last week, and I was like, well, you jackass, you know.
Yeah.
He didn't show me anything the week before to stay with him, so I was like, right, you're ditched, off to the bench, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he drifted away in the end, but his ball striking was, you know, the stats that accompanied that were really, really strong. So perhaps another one to keep an eye on as we go through the latter end of this European Tour season, which they've now added another three co-sanctioned South African Tour events at the back end of the year before we go to Dubai. So we're going to be busy all the way up until the middle of December this year.
We're going to be back in David Drysdale. The South African second place expert saves his card.
Yeah.
Every year in South Africa, David Drysdale.
He's been playing some better stuff, I suspect. He's
wasn't he leading at one point
last
week?
Yeah, he was right in the mix.
You knew that weren't going to last. That was right. But I didn't expect the Falamaki destruction trade.
No.
I saw the first bogey. I thought, And then next time I looked, 15 minutes later, he was down in like sixth. Bogey.
Yeah, I mean, to his credit, if you can give him that, he did birdie the last to get us a slight slither of the each way places. But by that point, you're kind of past the point of caring, really.
By that point, the bookmakers were doing a dance of delight.
A big sigh of relief.
As the unbacked Callum Shinquin.
But he would have been, Again, he hadn't done a great deal. He'd withdrawn his previous event, a couple of miscuts prior to that. 125-1, I think I saw about Callum Shinquin. So that tells you the story, doesn't it?
Right. Two events pre-Masters this week. I know that everyone's excited about the Masters and this week's almost like a sideshow, but we've got two events to talk through. I'm going to go with you first this week, Paul, because we have the Cyprus Showdown, and it is the most complicated golf tournament I've ever seen in my life. It makes the world match play look simple.
Well, yeah, it's another one of these hybrid events, shall we call it, where the European Tour have tried to differentiate from the norm and give us something a bit new and a bit innovative, which in the past has worked to a certain degree, hasn't it? We've seen the likes of the Super Six and the Belgian knockout and the clock shot Masters and a few things that have been quite well received. So it would be interesting to see how this goes. I guess they wanted to change things because we're playing two consecutive weeks on the same track as we played last week. So they wanted to differentiate things a bit and mix it up a little bit. But I'll take you through the basics of it, because once you understand it, it's relatively straightforward. As per last week, we've got 105 players. And for the first 2 days, nothing changes, really. We play stroke play for 36 holes. You'll have a normal leaderboard. Birdies are birdies, eagles are eagles. And everyone will just kind of jostle for position over that leaderboard for the first 2 days. At the end of Friday night, it gets interesting because you have a cut, which instead of being top 65 in ties, is top 32 in ties. So half of the players who would ordinarily make the cut are going to make the cut this time. At that point, Saturday morning, everyone's scores are reset. So everyone's starting on level par. So even if you were 10 shots clear after 36 holes, you will start in a tie for the lead with your other 31 or whatever peers who have also made the cut into the weekend. Everyone will play again, another 18 holes. It's stroke play, it's not match play, so don't get confused with these other hybrid events. 18 holes of stroke play. At the end of Saturday night, there'll be another cut. It's a top 16 and ties, so the field's halved once again. And once again, Sunday morning, the scores are going to be completely reset again. So on Sunday morning, we will have a 16-plus tie for the lead going into the final day. And everyone will play 18 holes the following day, and only those scores will count. So you're going to have to score particularly well on the Sunday, should you get there. Big potential for a playoff, given that everyone's starting on the same score. So you can have a large playoff unless someone goes absolutely crazy on Sunday and separates them from the rest of the field. It'll be interesting to see how it's received. I expect Sunday will be very interesting. I expect Sunday will be a fun day to watch. There'll be a lot of tales of woe, I'm sure, from players who are playing fantastically for 2 days. And if someone is 5 shots clear after 36 holes and ends up going home on Saturday night, then they're going to be particularly aggrieved, I would expect. But that is how this particular event is going to set up. So let's embrace it. Let's see what happens. And as we've seen with these other hybrid events, we've got a couple of betting options to consider with this. You've got the outright market, as you'd expect. And most of the bookies have kept their same terms that they've been offering over the last few weeks. So ranging from 5 each way and a quarter of the odds to 7 each way and a fifth of the odds. So on the outright market, if you get one of your players through to Sunday and you've got him each way, then you've got a pretty good chance of making some money out of that, given that you'll have approaching half of the field available, half of the places available, if you back them 7 places each way. The other option, of course, is you can go 36-hole leader, which means you'll just be betting on the players who are topping that leaderboard before all the fun and games starts over the weekend. And that's the same kind of thing that we've seen with these Super 6 and Belgian knockout formats over the last few years, where you've got a choice of playing either or market, or you can play both. And over the last few years, I've kind of refined my strategy with that to play even stakes across both markets, so that you're not disappointed, really. If you end up backing everyone in the outright market and the guy that you've backed is leading after 36 holes, then does nothing, you feel particularly aggrieved. And of course, the other way around is you could have a player who just about scrapes into the weekend and then goes forward and wins. And if you've only backed him in the 36 hole market, then of course you're going to be pretty upset. So half stakes and then just back them across both the 36 hole market and the outright market as well is how I am playing this, and exactly how I've played the Super 6 and the BKO, and actually had some decent, reasonably good success in those events. So fingers crossed that will manifest itself into something decent this week.
Can I ask Barry a question?
Go on.
Barry, from a psychological perspective, from a player's perspective, is this completely different to a normal 72 hole tournament, do you think? It's difficult to know.
It's hard to know. I've spoken about formats like this before, whether it's on this podcast or on my own one with James, back when we were doing them. And I thought it was a great format. I mean, just because it's all about constantly being on it or having the aggression to go after. It's just forcing the aggression to keep scoring well. And you don't always need to be the absolute best until the right moment. So it's about timing your run to a certain extent. You know, it's make it through, and then it's like go time. I think it's a cool format. I'm really looking forward to watching it. I don't know how it's going to go down. I don't even know if I'm going to put any bets on it. But I think it's one that the difference in this versus another tournament, say if you went compared it to an extreme example of a tough major test where you're kind of just trying to ease your way into the tournament with just a few solid pars, this one doesn't really afford you that time to mess around and kind of get a feel for the event and how it's flowing. It's just get on it really quickly. With that said, your risks have to be... You have to take a little bit more of a risk, but they have to be extremely well calculated and executed, because a double bogey probably means you're gone. Barring some serious run of birdies, a double bogey in this format, in any of the rounds, you're probably out of it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's going to make for a pretty exciting watch. They could have even gone as far as doing a cut to 8 players after 9 holes on the Sunday, just reset it again. I mean,
yeah.
Just steer all the way into the skid. There's variety that you could have with this format that would, you know, can add more excitement to it. So I kind of hope it works, because you might get some players giving out about it, but it's once a year, you know, at this rate for this particular one. So I think it's a cool thing, you know. You see different formats of the game. I'm not comparing apples with apples, cricket with golf, but, you know, you've got the T20 has grown and grown and grown in popularity over the years for cricket. I'm not saying this is going to be analogous to that, but it's going to be very interesting to see. And I think it's going to favour the aggressive players. A few of them will fall foul or victim to variance, but by making doubles, you know, at the least opportune moment. But yeah, I like the kind of aggressive birdie makers this week, if I was going to pick anyone.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. It's certainly going to shape a mindset with players as to how they approach it, because you've got to be up to the pace. I think the point you're making is absolutely right. Is if the cut is at 32 in ties rather than 65, you can't afford to plod along for the first 2 days. You've got to be really attacking this particular track and making birdies and eagles and minimising your mistakes, as you're saying. So otherwise, you're going to be out of the tournament.
Just, I mean, maybe a little angle, you know, to consider would be somebody who's been particularly successful at, say, Monday qualifying, or has gone through a few bouts of tour school over their career. So, you know, they've got that experience in those supremely high pressure one round scenarios, and they can execute in those situations. So, you know, if you can identify one or two guys that, you know, have decent experience, that matched with maybe a little bit of recent form, because that kind of, you know, boosts your confidence in choosing that guy, that could be an angle to be looking at.
Yeah, plenty of ways you can cut this one, I think. It's interesting how it's been priced up, because if you think about it, realistically, going into Saturday morning, everyone reset in terms of their score. You've got a 32-way tie for the lead. What's the favourite going to be on Saturday morning? You know, 20-1, 18-1. I don't think it's going to be a great deal shorter than that, unless someone's played absolutely incredible golf for the first 2 days to really give the indication that they're, you know, head and shoulders above everyone else. And that's kind of washed through to the main market, because 28-1, the field, is the current mark. So if you want to pick up the likes of a Thomas Dettry at 28-1 or Bobby McIntyre at 30-1, in this kind of field, you'd normally get nowhere near that price. But that's where they are. Schwab's 33-1. Garrick Higo won recently 33-1. Valimaki 33-1. Rasmus Højgaard, who's won twice over the last few months, 35-1. Rosner, Kinholt, Matthew Jordan, who's always perennially underpriced. Roman Langask, who won recently. Joost Luiten, 40-1, these players. Because of the way the market sets up, that's the price point that they've had to be put in at. But also means that the whole market's a little bit more, a little less stretched than you'd ordinarily see, because you've got a lot of players around that 45, 50, 60, 66 to 1 mark, who, again, if they make it through to the final 32, effectively going to be in that kind of, I don't know, 28, 33, 40 to 1 bracket again when they restart on Saturday. It will be interesting, because again, you're going to get the same scenario going into Sunday, down to 6. What's the favourite going to be on Sunday morning? 8 to 1? 10 to 1?
Doesn't Saturday and Sunday, they kind of set up like short field first round leader markets? Because you're only betting on the one round, but it's a shorter field.
Yeah, although even if someone's, on Saturday, someone's gone shot 61 and they're five shots clear of everyone else, they're still not going to be a ridiculously short price, because that score is going to get reset on Sunday morning. All it does is it tells you they're playing some good golf, or they've had one good round of golf to suggest they may go off and play well the following day.
Yeah, good luck backing up a 61.
Yeah, well, this is the point, isn't it? How many times do you see 61, 62? You don't, do you? 61, 71 is far more likely to be the way it manifests itself. So again, back to your point, it's those players who can you can just peak and find that one low round, but at the exact right time of the tournament, which is going to be Sunday. So yeah, fascinating format, and I hope it works, Barry, and it'd be fascinating to see how it works out over the course of the 4 days and what kind of reception it gets from the players and the commentators alike.
I mean, in an ideal world, all 16 would be playing at the same time in the same hole. Just to really amp it up. I mean, say you reduced it down to, say you did six holes. So you go from 16 down to 8 players, down to 4 players for the last 6 holes, and they're all playing together, and it's a shootout for the tournament over 6 holes. But that's kind of crossing over into the sixes a bit, so...
I'm assuming they're going to play it in leaderboard order. So whilst there's no...
Based on your Saturday results.
Yeah, exactly. So whilst there's no benefit in terms of your score to be top of the leaderboard at the end of any given day, if you end up getting a later tee time, then that may give you at least you can see what everyone else is doing. You get some feel as to whether you need to really, take that chance or not at any given point on the afternoon on Sunday. But
That's an advantage, worth pursuing, to keep you kind of motivated to keep scoring and pushing at the end of your Friday round, and then also your Saturday round, because it's very easy to take the foot off the gas and become a little bit protective
Your score,
because you don't want to make a big mistake to throw yourself out of it if you've got yourself comfortably inside the top half of the field going into Friday evening, or Friday going into Saturday and Saturday going into Sunday. It's going to be fun. There's going to be a lot of people almost avoiding the top of the leaderboard for the Friday, and because they don't want to make mistakes. So the winner of the 36 holes might actually get there by accident.
Yes, potentially. We'll see. It's going to be an interesting one. I'm looking forward to it, and we'll embrace it this year and see how it all pans out. But I guess the one good thing with this is we've got the same course as last week, so we've seen the track, we've seen how it sets up. PGA National in Cyprus, Aphrodite Hills Resort in Paphos. It's a 6,956-yard par 70-71. Coastal resort track, as we saw last week, large bent grass greens, fairly generous fairways. It's a resort track. It's designed for the travelling golfer who comes along and plays while they're on holiday. So it's not overly difficult. We saw last week 20 under was the winning total the top two guys got to at the end. 25 birdies over the course of the week was common. Lots of eagles as well. 3 of the par fives are eagle chances. There were 49 eagles altogether on those 3 par fives. It was only the third, which is the one that's in excess of 600 yards, that played a little bit tougher and didn't produce any eagles on the course of the week. The other three, as I say, they produced nearly 50 between them. Most of the field last week hit between 40 and 60% of fairways, so it was fairly consistent in terms of who was hitting what, and it was only really the greens and regulation that differentiated the top players. And again, 80%, 86 wasn't an uncommon sight to see in terms of greens and regulation. So accuracy wasn't the be-all and end-all. Hit greens and then make your putts. And if you can putt well on these bent grass greens, then you can get yourself into a position to make a decent score. And that's all we've really got to go on, really, is last week. So at least we have had a chance to see how it played last week. I mentioned before how I've played this in the past, or I've played these kind of events in the past. And what I've done this week is exactly how I've played the last couple of events like this. And I've literally split my stakes between the outright market and the 36-hole market, and just gone with three selections. So fewer selections, a point each way on each market for each player is how I've played it this week. So the three I've gone for: Jason Scrivener, firstly, 50-1 outright, 45-1 in the 36-hole leader market. One of the eye catchers last week, he opened with a double on Thursday, recovered over the course of the week, shot 23 birdies in total, finished in a tie for six. Led the field for par five scoring last week, 13 under for the 16 looks that he had at the par fives during the course of the week, which is pretty impressive, and closed with a 64, which was only beaten by Callum Shinquin and with his eagle, or his birdie eagle finish. Other than that, Scrivener was the closest in terms of a Sunday performance. 80.6% greens in regulation was right up there with towards the top of the market. And if you go back to the Irish Open a few weeks before, he led the field for putting that week as well. So some good signs in both his long game and also on the greens. What got me, though, what really twisted it for me was his last four Sundays scores. They read 68, 68, 65, 64. He's been scoring well on the Sundays, and he gets more of that this week. He's going to need more of that this week. Maybe he needs to go a shot or two deeper, I guess, on Sunday to lift the title. But he's certainly trending in the right direction in terms of his Sunday performances. So Scrivener, yeah, I think he's ripe for a European Tour victory. Sammy Valimaki has already got a European Tour victory. And I thought long and hard about whether to stick with him this week, and went all around the houses with it. But I've backed him. I've backed him at 35-1 outright. I've backed him at 30-1 in the 36-hole leader market too. And I guess, you know, save for those three holes on Sunday, the tournament was his. He played some fantastic golf. And will he get over that quickly? I think, you know, these youngsters who come on the tour and can quickly brush off adversity, you know, they could potentially be the ones to back and to follow. He's a five-time winner in his professional career so far across all the tours, so clearly he can go over the line. When he won in Amman earlier in the year, which is another seaside track, by the way, he'd finished seventh on his previous start. You had this other course doubleheader recently where we had the Celtic Manor, the two events at Celtic Manor. He finished sixth in the first one. He finished second the week after the Wales Open. So clearly, once you've got a look at the course, worked it out, and then he came very close the following week. So I'm going to stick with him, give him the benefit of the doubt this week, and hopefully he can improve on the 25 birdies that he produced last week and really get himself back in the mix. His putting looked really good. It backed up that stat that you said earlier, Steve, where he was first for greens and regulation at Wentworth. So long game looking good, short game looking good, putting looking good. Just don't make those mistakes on Sunday, please, Sammy, and bring home the bacon for us this week. Fingers crossed. So Valimaki's in, Jason Scrivener's in. The third and final player I've backed this week is Jeff Winter, 80-1 outright, 70-1 in the 36-hole leader market. And he was another eye-catcher last week. He led the field for putts per greens and regulation at 1.59, finished 14th overall. And he putted quite well earlier in the since lockdown as well, the Scottish Open, which again I think is another good indicator for this. Quite a few of the players who performed well last week also showed some decent form at the Scottish Open, so that might be a good correlating course to look at for this week. Hasn't won on the European Tour, but he was second at Joburg Open back in 2016, fourth at the Spanish Open last year, third at the Qatar Masters before lockdown. And if you look at that Qatar Masters leaderboard, Cali Samoa was in there, he was third. David Drysdale, you mentioned, Steve, was right up there last week. He
missed the South Africa.
he was second at the Qatar Masters as well. Again, looking at the way the course sets up, I think there's some good correlation there as well. So potentially some course form to cross-reference there for people who want to try and dig into it a little bit more. Both of those players, as I say, in the mix last week, both of them in the mix at the Qatar Masters, where Jeff was also in a tie for third. If he's going to win, he's going to need a big final day, as all of them are. For me, it's potentially a better 36-hole market player than the outright market, but I've stuck to my guns. I've backed these three players in both markets just to save any disappointment. He has done well in one of these kind of hybrid events before. After 36 holes, he was third into the weekend at the Belgian Knockout back in 2018 after leading after the first round. And he can close with a decent score. He shot 63 to finish off his Spanish Open effort that I mentioned earlier from last October. So he can shoot low in the final round. He can shoot low generally. Streaky kind of putter, very good putter when he's on form. And 80-1 outright, 70-1 in the 36-hole market seemed like a decent price to take. So they're my three, and that's where I'm drawing a line with it this week. And I'll just enjoy it. I guess from a punting perspective, don't be overly surprised if you back a few players and you've got no interest into the weekend or no interest into Sunday, because it's pretty harsh, the cut lines for this week. So
you're going to get some serious playoffs on Saturday, aren't you? In all likelihood, trying to get into that top 16.
They're not playing off; they're doing it in ties, so they'll all go through. Yeah, yeah, which would have added another element of intrigue.
That's so disappointing.
Yeah, it could, one of the options they could have taken, I guess, would have been.
I'd have liked a nice 8-man playoff for three spots or one spot.
Well, I
suppose it could have taken 5 hours, though.
Yeah, this is the point, isn't it? And you know, they've got daylight issues to try and contend with as well. So, it was. They've decided to just put everyone through on that same mark. Which, you know, if there's a lot of people tied for that last place, you could end up with 20 plus players going into the final day. But you know, I guess from their perspective, they want it as close to 16 as possible, and see how that manifests on Sunday.
On the exchange, Falamaki 34, Scrivener 55, Vjethinta 85.
I wonder, are they going to have to adjust the group sizings for Sunday then, based on that happening, if there are ties?
Yeah, I don't know. You'd imagine they're playing two balls, and just because there's not many of them on the course, and they can start it quite early. But
and they might have 1-3 ball if there's an odd number through.
Yeah, rather than a guy on his own, it'd make more sense, wouldn't it?
Off you go with Jeff Knox. Jeff needs to get a warm up in before Augusta next week.
You may not scamp around in 2 hours if you're doing that, given that you're in a tie for the lead effectively. You may want to take your time and see how everyone else is getting on, won't you?
We don't have any Cyprus players playing in the Masters next week, no?
Not that I've seen, no. It's a pretty poor field in effect, Steve, so.
We've got Rasmus flying Bermuda to America to... Well, I don't know. I take it he probably went Bermuda, Heathrow, Cyprus. Hmm. That's a journey.
Yeah, it was an odd one, isn't it? As soon as he didn't play last week for him to pitch up this week. But yeah, he's still in the field at the moment. So let's see if he's got any jet lag.
He's racking up some air miles. Hmm. Right, let's talk Houston Open. It's a wacky golf world that we live in. I mean, Houston Open has always been the traditional Masters curtain raiser in its April slot. Then it moved at the end of last year to a full series kind of spot away from the Masters. And then lo and behold, the Masters moves to it in 2020. And we've now got the Houston Open and the Masters in November. It's just a crazy... I don't know how we got there, but we've got there. The other thing is the Houston Open this time around has moved to a new golf course. So it's always been played at what I always used to know as Redstone. That then got changed to the Golf Club of Houston. But now basically the Houston Astros owner Jim Crane has got behind this tournament to keep it on the PGA Tour and keep it in Houston. And he wanted this golf tournament to be played at Houston's main municipal golf course, which is where we're playing it this week, Memorial Park Golf Course. Now, this golf course caters for 60,000 rounds per year. And Barry, Paul and myself could go and play there for $35.
That's not a bad
deal, really, is it, to play a PGA Tour golf course? And that's the goal here. They pumped in almost $20 million to get this golf course up to a kind of PGA Tour professional level. And he gave the renovation job to Tom Doak, who I think did the Renaissance Club build, which mm-hmm. was where they played the Scottish Championship a few weeks ago.
Yeah, Scottish Open, yeah.
Yeah, he's done one or two courses around the world. Yeah, quite prolific. But Brooks Koepka was involved as well, wasn't he?
Koepka was a player consultant. So when we go and play this golf course in the future, which clearly we will, we'll fly out to Houston and play it 1 week in our private jet, your scorecard comes with Brooks Koepka's signature on the back.
Very nice.
I don't think he signs them all individually. I think it's printed.
Yeah.
But anyway, you get the gist. He didn't want to be officially linked to the golf course, but he's PGA Tour player consultant. And reading through his input, he didn't want a plethora of long par threes. He wanted gettable par threes. And this is coming from the Doak Design website. With our consultant, Brooks Koepka, we agreed that our priority should be not to defend par. Oh, that's funny on the PGA Tour. Should not be to defend par, but to provide opportunities for dramatic lead changes and excitement for both golfers and fans. The first test of its success will be in November 2020. So it was a bit of a... It's a tough old brief, really, for Doak. It's kind of, we want you to refresh the golf course, and it needs to be PGA Tour standard for 1 week and a really exciting golf course that amateurs can play for the other 51 weeks.
Mm. Steve, the only thing they have to do for the PGA Tour week is just water the shit out of the golf course. The rest of the year, they just let it go dry and firm, and then it's fun for the regular golfer.
Mm. Well, when I'm reading, our priority is not to defend par. It tends to suggest 25 to 30 under par, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does shout birdie fest, doesn't it?
You raised a very good point off Mike. The Byron Nelson moved to Trinity Forest for a couple of years, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Which was a really innovative design in Dallas, which was basically a faux links.
Supposed to play firm and fast.
Crenshaw and Craw design.
Mm-hmm.
Core design, firm and fast, crazy sort of green designs and different, elevation changes and uneven lies. And they just watered the living hell out of it for 2 years, didn't they? Because they didn't want to upset the PGA Tour members and scare them off from playing.
And what happened? It just became a meaningless and bland golf tournament, and it's gone from there anyway. So why not play the course like it's intended to play instead of watering the shit out of it? This week on week score fest is just it's the same thing. It's like watching golf on Groundhog Day.
Yeah, that's why Bermuda last week was interesting, wasn't it? Because it was a small coastal golf course with 35-mile-an-hour winds. It was
brilliant
for 2 days. Yeah. It was actually very different.
Yeah. So, embrace the differences between the golf courses. You know, not all golf courses are the same. No two golf courses are the same. So, you should embrace the unique characteristics of it. And a course like this, not having seen it fully in depth on TV, let's say, with, you know, really great pictures from the cameras, it feels like the style that you'd get at Pinehurst number two, with, you know, maybe with less bunkers, but those elevated kind of greens,
yeah,
runoff areas, you're able to put it up. I like what they're saying about the idea of for the course is like, remove the bunkers, which are, you know, easier for pros, but hazards, yeah, for amateurs. Amateurs can still get the ball up onto the green with a putter or a hybrid or a wood or, you know, bump and runs. It sounds, the brief for the course sounds brilliant. If they let the course play like it's designed to play. So please, I hope like somebody sabotages the water pumps this week. That would be, you know.
I get the feeling, this is my view, it's a 7,432 yard par 72. It features five par fives and five par threes. The fairways look like they're Heathrow Airport wide. There are trees on the golf course. You've got to be very, very wayward, I think, on most of the drives to be getting into tree trouble. And apparently, and you can see it, it's not exactly Wentworth kind of depth of density of tree. It's kind of sparse. There hasn't been a lot of water in the build-up, so I think you're going to get firm fairways, long run, not overly penal rough, and green complexes that are watered beyond existence. I think it's going to be taken apart. And that, to me, suggests, you know, people are talking about, oh, yeah, there's no, yeah, no bunkers. Yep, got that. There's a lot of runoff around the greens. A lot of, you know, the odd false front. And I think you're going to be able to get away with just putting from off the green. And I think if you're a high GIR monster and you're hitting a lot of greens, you're going to be cantering up a good score here. Bearing in mind that the first they're playing is a 500-yard hole. It normally plays as par four, but the PGA Tour have said it's a par five this week.
Boys, we're going for a new scoring record on the PGA Tour this week. We're going for 38.
Because I read, oh, this will play as a par 70, a stretching 70, and then a lot of the locals say, well, normally we play it as a 71, and then the scorecard comes out and they've changed the first from a par four to a par five. My lord.
So we need to find a market for a 59 this week, then.
Could be
a 58. Oh God, this is going to be yeah.
It puts me off a few players because when you get a golf course that's going to clearly be scorable, it, and especially when we're having a run at the moment of 200, 275 to one winners, it lowers the bar, doesn't it? Yeah, anyone could come along and win this.
Exactly, yeah. It doesn't separate the field. It kind of condenses it even more.
Mm. So I think it's an angle where you want to look for guys that are free scorers. And there are players towards the top of the... a lot of the elite kind of players, they don't tend to play many of these birdie fests, do they? I know it's becoming more common. But, you know, usually they play a schedule of Memorial and Quail Hollow where, you know, a good 15 under par wins, not like 28, 29, this kind of ridiculous scoring level. So, yeah, if you see Tony Finau winning his second PGA Tour title at 20-1 this week at 27 under par, you know, or Hideki Matsuyama, it just doesn't feel right, does it? It doesn't. And Tony's not going to destroy his each-way price for the Masters next week, is he, surely? So back Tony for you now. They're Miniverde Bermuda grass greens. Now, Miniverde Bermuda grass is pretty... it's become less common on the PGA Tour. It tends to be now all Tiff Eagle or Champion. If you're looking for some course comps, they still got Miniverde, to give it its full title, Miniverde Tiff Dwarf greens at Eastlake, where they played the Tour Championship. They also have the same greens at TPC Louisiana, where they play that team event. And if you go back in time, they used to play the same kind of green surfaces at the Players, TPC Sawgrass. And they used to also play them at Quail Hollow, I think 14, 15 and 16, the Wells Fargo. Your friend James Harm won one of those, Barry. So James Hahn is a Miniverde Bermuda grass green winner. Tip bit for you. The greens at the golf course of Houston, where they used to play this, were mini Verde Bermuda grass, but they used to overseed them for the Masters. So they used to have velvet bent grass on the top of them and played like bent grass. Last year they didn't, though. They played as this mini Verde. That was the one that Lanto Griffin won. And Lanto's getting some interesting... he's being well back this week. Personally, I tend to stay away from defending champions, especially first-time defending champions on the PGA Tour. But I will say one thing about Lanto. He defended a title on the web.com Corn Ferry, and he won it 1 year, and then he went and defended it, finished second the year that he defended the year after. So he has had some experience and good, positive experience of defending a professional title. So Griffin could be one to look at. Apart from that, it's difficult to kind of... I mean, five par fives was the thing for me. It's just going to... I'd be amazed if this is 15, 16 under par. I think it's going to go a lot deeper than that.
Yeah, it really doesn't sound like it, does it?
Bearing in mind, Russell Henley won 2017 at the old golf course at 20 under. I think it's going to have a two on the end of it. A two at the start of it, even. The winning score. Right. With all of this crazy prices at the moment, chasing short prices doesn't seem to be the way ahead overly. I also had a quick look, and this might be of interest to listeners. I looked, going back to the start of 2015, at winners of tournaments the week before a major. And it's quite an interesting pattern, actually. 2015, Jordan Spieth won John Deere Classic the week before the Open. We've had, of course, some of these events tend to be WGCs with a elite field. So Lowry won 2015 at the, what was it called? Firestone South, which used to be the old WGC Bridgestone. We've seen Dustin Johnson win. We've seen twice. He's won both the WGC. He also won the FedEx St. Jude Classic the week before the US Open in 2018. He was ranked at two in the world for both of those. Spieth was ranked two in the world. Last year, Rory McIlroy won the Canadian Open the week before Pebble Beach. He was ranked four in the world. So, and we had Justin Thomas this year winning the WGC at St. Jude the week before the PGA. He was three in the world. So looking at that, if you were going to choose one, you could say, well, Dustin Johnson's going to come out post-COVID. Him not playing doesn't really bother me because he's won quite a few tournaments after months of inactivity. He could just come out and keep that form going and win this at, what, am I seeing 15 to 2 out there? But that's an option. There's a couple of winners dotted around the high 40s. Lowry was 48 in the world. Berger was 43 and 46 when he won 2 years on the trot at Southwind. Poulter was 51st in the world when he won the year he qualified for the Masters here at Houston. He was 51. We've also seen JB Holmes win. He was ranked 20 in the world when he won at 2015 here at the Houston Open, although it was on a different course. And then you just get some just weird and wacky 203s and all manner of stuff. So I know... Sung Kang's interested you. He won last year, the week before the US Open, in Texas.
Mm. Yeah, he was second in this back in, what, 2017, wasn't it?
He's got absolutely no form. He's a huge price. He's likely to win. 400 to 1 I'm seeing out there on Sung Kang.
Is he?
That's crazy, but then his form sort of is crazy, but this is it. Anything can pop right now. Mm. I looked at Brian Guy. It was absolutely, as you said, Paul, at the top of the show, if you wanted a 200 to 1 player that was short, good on coastal courses and had hideous form, Brian Guy was your man. Yeah. And if you back like that, I wouldn't have thought Sung Kang is a bad bet this week, especially at that kind of price. But I have gone for the old route of Bermuda positive players and kept it quite simple. I do think Bombers will go well this week. My prices are relatively short. Well, I'll say that. I mean, 25 to 1 is the shortest. I've gone for Scotty Scheffler at the top. Texas boy, long as you like. For the length of driver this guy at, he is a brilliant driver of the golf ball. He's sitting in the top 15 over the last 8 weeks for driving accuracy, and he's bombing it 320. You just get the feeling that these five par fives, he's going to take them apart. The difference between him since the Tour Championship, where he finished second across the 72-hole score and he was fifth in the strokes gained index, yeah. Bearing in mind, that was on Miniverdi, yeah. His approach play hasn't got back to that peak of where it was before he caught COVID, but it's warming. It was negative, then it was positive, and then last time out at the Zozo, he was better with his irons, and he shot, I think he was fourth at 36 holes, so he's clearly getting there. And you say to Scotty Scheffler, you know, mentally, strokes gained mental, if you look at it, or strokes gained motivation. He's in Texas. He hasn't won on the PGA Tour. He's playing the Masters next week, and I'm sure Scotty would like to play well there, but I doubt if he really thinks he's going to win there. This week, though, big opportunity. So I just thought 25 to 1, 2 points each way, William Hill on the eight places for Scotty Scheffler, who's clearly does like Bermuda grass. And bearing in mind, this guy shot 59 in August, didn't he? On a par 71 golf course in Boston. And,
yeah, he's shown some very good scoring form post-lockdown, yeah.
He's not putting positively from a strokes game perspective, but he's still in the top 20 for putts per GIR. So when he's hitting greens, he's converting chances. Mm. And you do see this disparity, and the American strokes gained way of, you've got to be positive for strokes gained putting. But that isn't really the case, is it? In a way, I like the balance of the two. If someone's still making a good putting average and is still converting their chances when they've made a green in regulation, they're getting the ball in the hole ultimately, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. Scoring, yeah.
Doesn't matter that they're not making 50-yard putts. They're just making lots of 6 and 7 foot putts.
Yeah, I like you've just said there. I like to look at a blend of the two numbers, really, and. Again, you can build a narrative around one or the other, can't you? Depending how you want to you want to tailor it. But if you can find a player who's seemingly putting well from one of the metrics, then it can point you in a certain direction.
It's Tyrrell Hatton. You know, he's in my. You know, with a player like Hatton, he's making good yardage and he's making lots of putts.
Yeah.
You're not getting the positive yardage with Scheffler, but. To still be sitting in the top 20 in my 8 week tracker for putts per GIR, he's clearly getting the ball in the hole. Mm. So QED, really. I've then gone for our old friend. There was a little bit of 66s yesterday afternoon. That soon got snapped. There's 50 to 1 out there right now. I've taken the eight places on 45s. I'd be happy with a 45 to 1 winner. I've gone 1.5 points each way. Siwoo Kim. I just think Siwoo's trending towards something. And as we know, two-time win on the PGA Tour, both wins on Bermuda grass. I won't list out all of his amazing finishes on Bermuda grass. He was fifth for strokes gained tee to green last time out at Shadow Creek. And I saw on YouTube, you know, a lot of these, every shots are now available on YouTube. And I watched him play with Rory McIlroy in round one. And he played some fantastic stuff from tee to green, Siwoo Kim.
Yeah, and he had been putting particularly well prior to that, hadn't he? So if you can marry the two together, then he's just about due a big week, isn't he?
Whether Siwoo Kim can get to 22, 25 under par, I don't know. Well, but saying that, well, I'm going against myself here. If you actually think about it, a few weeks ago at the Shriners, he was 18 under par to finish in a tie for eighth. Mm. And that came with a minus 269 in round four. So actually, if he'd have shot, I don't know, 67, 66, he'd have been virtually tying for the lead up there with Wolf, Cook and Laird. and we'd have all been, oh, well, he can make birdies. It's just, I think a lot of this is schedules, isn't it, and what courses you play. So I've gone for Siwoo Kim. I know, Barry, you'd have probably gone for him if he was 150 to 1, wouldn't you? But
that's too short at 150s.
Would you have taken... You'd have had him at 66s, I think.
I don't know. He's burnt me so many times. It's just the pain.
He'll come good at some time, Siwoo Kim.
I know, but it's hard. Like, you know, it requires several therapy sessions.
The other thing with Kim is, and I still love this angle at this time of year, he's 88th in the world. He needs, he would crave a big, big finish to get him close to the world's top 50. The same can be said for another one. And if you, as I said, Barry, soft greens, I think if you're a greens in regulation monster, you've got a chance this week. Corey Connors, I've gone 1.5 points each way, 55-1 with Betfred, 7 places each way on Corey Connors. Who, again, is a terrible, diabolical putter. Absolutely diabolical putter. They also say he's an auto bogey if he misses a green. Well, this place might not be so bad because he hasn't got to chip so much. He can putt from off the green. But actually, when I'm looking at the statistics for him, bearing in mind he finished like a train in the final round last time we saw him at the Zozo. If you actually look across my 8-week trackers, which were available, of course, in my preview this week, he's sitting in the top 17 for strokes gained putting right now. And he's also doing a half-decent job with his scrambling. So you look at his strokes gained numbers from putting perspective, the only time he really does get deep in those numbers is on Bermuda grass greens. And actually, you look at his history, prior to the Corn Ferry, he played a couple of years down in South America on the Latino America Tour, so it kind of makes sense that he's very used to Bermuda grass greens in the Southern Hemisphere. And all of, you know, Mexico and...
His win on tour was in Texas.
Yes. And it was the week before the Masters. It was last year.
Dun, dun, dun. Why would you back anybody else this week, people?
Now, those greens did have a overseed, but they were Bermuda grass base. So, yeah. I think Corey Connors is a good shout this week. And then I've gone for a guy that seems to be absolutely friendless in the market, but is an absolute Bermuda grass monster. And he was fourth as recently as three weeks ago or 4 weeks ago. The postman, JT Poston. 90-1, 8 places each way with Paddy Power. I'm seeing no one backing him whatsoever. I think Poston's a great shout this week.
Yeah, what was that? Sedgefield, he had the high finish, was it?
He won at Sedgefield. He was, sorry, I sold him short. He was third at the Sanderson Farms Championship.
That's right, yeah.
A 7,400-yard par 72 on the, you know, at the start of October. Mm. And actually, he's a 310 hitter. Most of them are these days, aren't they? He's not short. He averaged 309 yards off the tee at the CJ Cup last time at Shadow Creek. I know that's at altitude a little bit, but he's definitely a 300-plus driver of the golf ball. So if he wants to get it out there, he can. Poston's weakness is his driving accuracy, but when you've got fairways this week that are kind of huge and wide, that kind of takes that out of the equation, and there isn't a lot of water around landing areas. There was at Shadow Creek when he finished 51st last time, so you're missing fairways, you're can be very wet, and I expect he was. but his approach plays sharp right now, and he is a formidable Bermuda grass putter because he's from South Carolina. He lives in St. Simon's Island, Georgia, with, you know, in that golfing commune over there on the Atlantic coast. And by that guy can go low. I think when he won the Bermuda, he won at 22 under the Wyndham Championship. So give him a birdie fest, Bermuda greens. I just really like his chances. All seven of his highest official world golf ranking results have come on Bermuda grass fairways with Bermuda grass rough. he's a, you take him on anything ryegrass or anything upstate, nowhere near as effective. Just he knows what he likes and he knows how the ball reacts. I tell another one I came close to, who's triple digits, Branch Snedeker.
Yeah, he's been showing some form, hasn't he? The results, you know, if you eyeball the actual result line, doesn't look that great. But there's been snippets in there of
But he's been in late groups on Sunday. His last two outings, and I read some notes with him, and he said that he's completely changed his whole back group. I think he's got a new caddy. He's got a new swing coach. He's basically revolutionised the whole team. And all of a sudden, lo and behold, Brandt is actually hitting some fairways, a good amount of them. And we just know he's a phenomenal putter.
Yeah, likes to be a Bermuda as well, doesn't he?
Whether he's got the real power and grunt to overpower this golf course, don't know. But he's also a phenomenal scorer. If we're going right down into the depths, which I know you guys must be having a field day this week.
Definitely.
The one that I thought was quite good is Andrew Landry. 225-1 with Bet365. He's 200-1 generally. He's been playing some nice golf under the radar, Landry.
Yeah, it's another one
he does like over a 28 under par winning score, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's another one who has proven that he can actually go over the line where so many just stutter towards the end.
He's like a TBJ, isn't he? When he's in contention, he wins. He beat Scheffler at the PGA West earlier this year in a shoot. I think it was him, Anser, and Scheffler, and Landry never blinked. Just took him out.
Yeah.
Right, who are you guys backing at ridiculous odds this week?
You go, Barry. I've only got one that I've backed. You go first.
You mean one that you're officially announcing on the podcast, but you're actually backing a whole bunch on the sly?
I am going to back Sung Kang now that we've mentioned him far too many times for me not to back him. But
I just did as well. I'm going to go with James Hahn this week. He has had three top tens his last three outings. Is a green in regulation machine at the moment, and that's I really like that angle this week. Just giving himself lots of looks at birdies. So let's see, can he continue that, or maybe just up that form just a little notch more? It doesn't seem afraid of going low either in terms of scoring, so that's it's a little plus for him this week. I've a few others. John Ho was good in his last outing.
You're going for Hahn and Ho.
Hahn and Ho, yeah.
Let me stop you, Barry. In my trackers this week, James Hahn ranks second for strokes gained total, yeah? And he also ranks sixth for strokes gained tee to green. And you're grabbing him at 80-1. Makes a lot of sense.
Off the back of what, three consecutive top 10 finishes?
Yeah.
And he's a winner on Mini Verde Bermuda Grass Greens at Quail Hollow.
So,
I've got a post-it note, and he was the last off the shortlist, so there you go. That's a good tick.
Please don't back him, Steve. I need this win.
I'll take the My only doubt with him is how many players do you see go four straight each way returns? On the PGA Tour. It's a rarity, isn't it? It is a rarity.
He is also not playing them consecutive weeks. He's had breaks in between.
That's
true. So
he's got gaps
between. That is a help. Like if he was playing week on week, I would really struggle to do that. But he's had a little break, so he's not going to... Yeah, he's not coming
off. He's on a major medical, so he must be getting very, very close to ticking the box on that.
With the top tens, yeah, for sure. Especially, a fifth, a sixth, and a ninth. Like, there's some decent points in there. He just needs to get, the equivalent points of the last qualifying player from the previous season.
You got it.
Yeah, he's ticking along nicely there. So, a couple of others, just long ones. But before that, we'll just pass over to Paul before I dominate the long shots.
I haven't backed Denny McCarthy, but he was one that tempted me. I will back Sung Kang because we talked about him off mic, and you made a very good case for him earlier, Steve, as well, so he's going in. The one I have backed is Keith Mitchell at 250-1, who hasn't done a great deal since lockdown, but prior to that, he was fifth at the Arnold Palmer. 49th last week doesn't shout impending victory, but then if you look back to his win at the Honda Classic last year, on Bermuda Greens, he beat Fowler and Koepka that week. And that was off of very little form, and he won at 300-1 that week. He actually closed last week with a 66, which gives him a little bit of momentum coming into this. Ball striking looked really good. First for total driving last week at Bermuda. So clearly found something with his long game as well, which I think if you're hitting long and finding fairways, you're going to give yourself an awful lot of chances this week. So an aggressive player like Mitchell could well compete, I think. Sixth in Texas in the past at the 2018 Houston Open. Third at the Byron Nelson as well, 2018, which you mentioned a little bit earlier. So there's a few things tying him into this, I think. And his current form line looks awful, hence the reason you're getting 250-1. But I don't think you need to dig that deep into it to find that there's a little bit more to like about him this week. There weren't enough first round leader markets up to back him first round leader, but if I can get somewhere circa 150-1 for first round leader as well, then he's the kind of player who can pop up very early on as well in a tournament. So well worth a look on that market as well for Keith. But yeah, it's the only one that I've backed so far, and I will back Sung Kang at that mad price you mentioned earlier.
Mitchell is ridiculously Bermuda grass positive. I think he's Floridian, isn't he? So yeah, makes all the sense in the world. Yeah.
But yeah, that's me, Barry Gunn. You finish us off this one.
I don't know. Like, I mean, who is it? Was it one of you guys said Sean O'Hare?
He's a Texas. I looked on the predictor model and we've got a Texas result variable and it runs over 5 years. And I looked at it and it was just madness. He was like in the top four in the field. I thought, I could be wrong. And when I looked into it, it's a litany of Texas results. It's one after the other.
Like, if you're going to just pick something like that, Last week, Brian Gay had good results in Bermuda, but like crap leading up to it.
Absolutely.
Sean O'Hare has a miscut of 14th, a miscut and a miscut as his last four outings. For shits and giggles, like I also, you know, just point people towards a podcast. I think it was the golf.com one with Colt Nost. The Sean O'Hare one was very interesting to listen to.
Yeah.
A bit of a fan of his since that. So, yeah, 300-1, why not?
Kevin Tway's another one that's slowly but surely starting to find his way. Kevin Tway, slowly but surely, he's been absolute dire garbage.
He did have a purple patch in this kind of fall series a couple of years back, didn't he? 2 or 3 years back.
I think
seemed to recall.
Tway won at Silverado, the first event a couple of years back, and he was one of the ones that dined out on it. I think he hit the champagne or whatever. I'm counting 6 or 7 missed cuts in 2019 in a row, and oh my lord, at the start of 2020, I'm counting 8 missed cuts this year. You just notice with his numbers, they're starting to get better. He's getting better at hitting the ball straight, long, and hitting some fair, and hitting some greens. He was 40th last week. You can just tell these players when they're clearly working on fundamentals that are their strengths, and eventually something will click, and they'll just hit the ground running. Tway's got some decent results in Texas as well. So yeah, I mean. We could mention 700. We could mention 70 of these long shots, couldn't you?
Just through the field. Yeah. There's a few you could pin a little bit onto. So I expect DJ wins.
I doubt it very much. There'll be a few interesting long shots for first round leader as well from some of these guys. You know, you can definitely find some long odds out there.
Yeah.
And that's my kind of like long odds week. Just. punted out there.
Before we go, do you like to, on first round leader, do you look at their closing round at the last tournament and if they've got momentum? You know, a decent Sunday becomes a great Thursday the next time they play. Is there something in that?
It's certainly you're kicking on into it with a decent vibe, you know. If you're thinking back to what was my last round and you shot like a 64 or 65 to close out the tournament, you know, you're starting off the next one with a very positive frame of mind. So, yeah, have a look at who's got obviously their first round scoring average for recent events and also for that particular course, if you can find that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that'll give you a little short list. And, you know, having a look at what they shot like on the weekend or the Sunday before this event, that could be the little thing that helps you choose between one or two guys or to try cut that shortlist down to a manageable number of players to back.
Because it's interesting, Mal Natty finished like a train at the Shriners Open, and then last week he got first round leader at the Bermuda Open, Bermuda Met Championship.
Yeah. It does happen. It does happen where you maintain that momentum for another round.
That's us then. When are we recording our Masters research podcast? Well, are we going to do that Wednesday, Thursday?
Yeah, Thursday probably makes more sense. But we'll agree off air and we'll get Thursday. That out to listeners as soon as we possibly
can. There will be a Masters research podcast out either Thursday evening or Friday morning. And then we'll do our usual Tuesday podcast next week for the 2020 Masters. It's been a pleasure, gentlemen. Thank you for your time.
Yeah, best of luck, guys.
Good luck, everybody.
Best of luck to you two and best of luck to listeners. As I said, great time to get a 5-star review in on Apple Podcasts. We will read it out across the next 2 Masters podcasts. So if you could do that, it'd be wonderful. I appreciate your time and we'll see you again very soon. Goodbye.